This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Steve Bobe.
Taking care of business and working overtime.
With market insights and so much more, talk to Steve now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Steve Bobe.
Oh, good afternoon. Welcome to the Money Talk Show. This is AM 790, your station for talk and business. Well, the markets were mostly positive today. Small cap stocks about flat for the day. The rest of the index is pretty positive. Good earnings reports from some of America's greatest tech companies like Apple and Facebook. Here we are now in 1 month into the year. January is a pretty good indicator of things. It's been slightly positive. S&P up 1.5 or so, I guess, year to date. A good sign for the year. There's a very heavy pattern over time. It's not 100%. Almost nothing is in the financial world, but it's about 80% of the time that as January goes the year. And I believe Nathan pointed out that last year or the year before was one of those Januaries. It did not indicate what the year would look like, but a good strong percentage of the time. And anything above 50 in the financial world is somewhat usable, you know, when you're making decisions about things. Emerging markets are emerging. We've talked about that before. If you're younger, especially, I think you want to have a piece of this. You'll find them in 401k plans, but pretty seldom, I think, unfortunately. One of the problems. Offering all of you every investment choice in the world. In your what if I hand you a book that has 310 mutual funds in it and say, go ahead, pick whatever one you want? Is that really helping you? Probably not, right? So anyway, make sure you have some international exposure. I believe the next few years, 2 years or so, seems to be the cycle. Rates rising here in the U.S., although the vibration we're getting from the Fed now is to be cautious and not be in a hurry. We already had an increase. Mortgages are above 4% for the first time in a long time. So again, we're back to that conversation again about interest rates and how high interest rates are great for the older folks. And I'm in that group. I'm 58. Older meaning, say, above 40, you know. And the younger people have to borrow. So low interest rates are best for them. And if they do have any money to invest, they don't think of investing in CDs and things when they're younger. They've been coached better than that. Long-term growth is usually going to be a more rewarding place to be if you're younger and have long-term, you know, on your side. This is the Money Talk Show for a full hour. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. Tonight on the program, I wanted to share a little story with you all that I had a nice conversation with a client in the office. I do this as often as I can. I call it just advisor tales. It's something that really actually happened in my office. And I had a gentleman who I've had for a client for a long, long time make a comment that I thought was dangerous. And I wanted to I shared it with him that it was dangerous and why, and very politely, I hope. And I wanted to share it with you all as well. This gentleman was above 70 and a half years old and was referring to a bank account or something like that he had, an IRA. And he said that the return on the investment didn't even equal the withdrawal he had to make. Now, at 70 and a half years old, if you have IRAs, not Roths, a traditional IRA 401k type pre-tax money, you must begin making withdrawals. It's about 2.5% the first year, and it goes up. The amount you must take out goes up every year based on tax law. So if your basic philosophy about your IRA is that the withdrawal each year, the mandatory withdrawal that you're facing, the investments must produce at least that, you are on an ever-inclining risk ladder to take you to the land of inappropriateness, which means 7 years into that philosophy, you now have a 12% withdrawal requirement on the account, and you're 80 years old. You should not have investments in anything that are targeted to make 12% per year. That's much too much risk. So there is a time in your life where these two lines will have a divergence, and you cannot try to keep them together. Now, I've heard this comment more than once in my career, and I've always been very uncomfortable with it because it will eventually lead a person to having much, much too much risk in their portfolio for their age. And if I'm the advisor on that account, that's not going to happen. So we need to not only learn new things all the time, and that's what the Money Talk Show is here for. But we also need to go back and sometimes relearn some of the things that we've all been mistaught, possibly, right? Another favorite one of mine is income taxes. And we talk about things being tax deductible, and that's not true at all. They're income deductible. If they were tax deductible, that's called a tax credit. And if you take a tax deduction, what you would call, and I've even called it that myself, but it's not really appropriate. And I think if we all, we in the profession especially, of course, are setting an example of speaking and being as precise as we possibly can, the more precise you are in any conversation, the less likelihood of misunderstanding there'll be, almost always. So being precise in your words, I think, is very, very important. So you want to make sure that you don't make that mistake.
You know, that reminds me of a famous thing you'd like to talk about, a misunderstanding and being specific with your words, is when the market talks about a sell-off, right? You hear this all the time. There was a huge sell-off in the market today. And you always laugh and remind me, well, Nathan, remember, anytime someone's selling something, there's also someone buying something.
Right, and they don't think it's a bad time. Otherwise, they wouldn't be buying it.
That's right.
So just as many people think it's a good thing, but that's the media using it to serve their purposes better, right?
You could say that. Yeah.
They wouldn't say it, because bad news sells first. If it bleeds, it leads. Unfortunately, that's human nature. I think, you know.
One time, when you were out a few weeks ago, you were on your fishing trip. I was here with Don, and we were talking about that very topic, about the sell-offs, the buy-offs. And he said something interesting that I thought was worth noting, was that when they say there's a sell-off, maybe what they're trying to imply is that the seller had more motivation. Right, the people who are selling are more motivated to sell, and the people who are buying are just saying, okay, I'll take it if you're looking to get rid of it.
Yeah, I like that.
You know, if you're approaching your child's college days, you're more motivated to sell your assets to liquidate them and pay for your children's education.
Sure. Or it could be usually a lot more buyers than sellers in volume. But at the end of the day, every share that's sold had to be bought, just like real estate, right?
Right.
Just like a home. And if no one wants to buy your home, what's it worth?
Zilch.
Right. That's why you want to be careful, folks. If you're new to the stock game, and young people often do this, and it's okay to do it with smaller money, don't take a big risk. But you can buy a stock on the stock exchange. Let's say you bought it at $3 a share. It goes up to $80 a share. And you put in an order to sell it at $80, and it doesn't sell. Nobody's ever heard of the company before. It's thinly traded, you know. And it drops to 70. And you call up your brokerage house again. You say, wait, what's going on here? I told you to sell this thing. And they say, yeah, the order's been in the market for 10 days. No takers.
You want to sell it for less?
Right. You want to sell for less? Well, exactly right. Yeah, now you'll get a bite, right? But the point is, you could watch that gain go all the way back down to $3 without being able to find a buyer. And this is what people don't understand about smaller stocks that are not heavily traded, have a lot of liquidity. So if you're going to mess around with individual stocks, please make sure it's a company that you could always get out of if you need to, not only from an investment strategic decision-making standpoint, but what if something unexpected happens in your life and that money was for someone that you love, and you can't get it out?
Right.
You know, and these are things people just don't think of when they dive into this stuff.
The word in the financial world is marketability.
Yes.
Is a security marketable, which means can it be quickly converted into cash? Now, that doesn't always mean that it has liquidity, right? I mean, liquidity could be if you want to get something for the price that you paid for it. If something could be marketable.
At what price?
So if it's volatile, right, and the price is going up and down, that exemplifies that it doesn't have very good liquidity, but it is marketable. You could sell it very easily.
Right.
So
right.
a very volatile individual stock could have some liquidity risk in the sense that you might not get what you paid for it, and it could be down significantly.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Because, a trade is a two-sided experience, folks. But keep that in mind, you know. I had a little experience early in my career, and I've shared it all with you all over the years, where a nice gentleman asked me to buy a stock or sell a stock. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, everything was done correctly. And a week later, he calls me, and I told him, I gave him an explanation. He was very dead quiet on the phone, like he was suspicious. But I explained to him what was going on. The details are hard to remember at this point. It's 20 years ago. I got a little lawyer letter, about a month later, and I had to educate the lawyer that was coming after me to threaten me. Didn't even understand how it worked. Didn't understand that you could put an order in for a stock that doesn't sell. So all we had to do was send them copies that we proved that we listed it, and we put it to sell it at the price the client insisted upon.
Right.
That's why I didn't sell. It was just like a house, right? You put the price too high.
Sure.
Not going to get any increase. It must drive real estate agents crazy, huh? when a person wants to list the house too high. Yeah. And it's always worth more when it's mine, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right?
Sure, sure.
And I think that's probably one of the plights of the real estate agent.
It's like my guitar.
It popped into my head. Sorry, off track.
That guitar I sold last year, it was worth way more than I sold it for. Well, I'll tell you right now.
It was yours. You made it sing, baby.
That's
so,
right.
So that's understandable, you know. But if you're getting into the financial world, please take a look at these new ETFs, exchange-traded funds. They are highly cost-effective. You can purchase them at very little cost. And you can, more importantly, you can buy whole industries. If you think because of the new president that we have that the oil industry is going to do really well, well, you can buy it. You could always do this with a mutual fund, but these new ETFs are available, you know, in pistachio, Nathan. It's actually too many flavors. And then there are all sorts of psychology applications now to these ETFs. There are hedge this, hedge that.
Right.
You can get one that's X technology in case, let's say you work for a tech company. Your whole career is in technology. And you got a tech fund in your 401k plan. You want to make a private investment on the outside, but you like technology, but you got too much of that one company. There's flavors are, I don't know how anyone on their own could ever comprehend all of it. What did you show me in the database last year was 300,000
different ETFs, mutual funds, and ETFs. You mentioned the ETF situation. Now you see a lot of ETFs actually folding.
Yes.
Right?
Not enough coverage.
They're ambitious. They think that this will spark some demand and people will get interested and invest in this. And it turns out that not many people are interested in investing in an index in toy soldiers.
That's what I'm saying. When you get too many flavors.
Something random or arbitrary.
You get too specific. It's a smaller market.
Right, sure.
And the fund has to be a certain size for it to function, if it even exists. I've never had an ETF close out on us because we tend to favor the very big, well-traded. It doesn't mean there aren't some other good ones. There are.
Right.
But we favor, because we have a fiduciary responsibility, we try to favor the ones that will always have that liquidity.
Right.
Or we think will have the highest likelihood.
Yep.
Nothing's guaranteed ever in the financial world
of
running it that way. This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790, a station for talking business, and Nathan and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talk and business. Hey, I don't know that you need a financial product when you retire to give you income on your money. How about just taking a big pile of money, invest it moderately with a target return of 6%, withdraw 10% per year, that's more than the return, so the account will decline steadily, and it should last 15 years. Now, most people, if they retire, let's say 65, and did that with an IRA account, that would take them to age 80. That's life expectancy. You don't have to, follow that philosophy exactly. When you're getting close to the end there, you could slow the withdrawals down. You could always, I always said that if I was to retire and I was given two options that really involved the same lump sum value, Nathan, if you asked me, because you're a little young to be able to see this, I'm closer to retirement. If you said to me, Stephen, for all your hard work, you can either have, you're going to have $4,000 a month for life in retirement. I would smile and say to you, can I have $5,000 the first half and $3,000 the second half?
Right.
And I would take that every single time.
Well, sure. I mean, in your beginning years of retirement, that's when you're the youngest. That's when you're the most, you have the most energy. That's when you're the most willing to travel.
If you have a spouse, you still have him or her.
Correct.
To do it with, because you know what? It's not a lot of fun alone.
That's right.
Walk around this planet with a big pile of money in your pocket all by yourself.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, great point.
The older you get, the more you realize that people are what matters. And my great, one of my great mentors, James Rohn, once said, better to live in a tent on the beach with a friend than in a mansion by yourself.
How true is that?
And so that's why I'm trying to tell clients, if you've been married, nice couples I had, they've been married like mom and I, 30 years plus. You got to dig each other to hang in there that long, right?
I think so.
In a very deep, intrinsic way, right? Most of the time, you'd hope, right?
Yeah.
So that's unique in itself, to have a relationship that's that long, all those great memories, children, grandchildren, and now you have some money to enjoy it, and the clock's ticking. You know, age 75 or so is usually when people tell me they want to reduce their withdrawals because it's more than they need. I have this amazing woman in Florida named Laura. You know who she is?
Sure.
She called me yesterday to tell me she wants to reduce her withdrawals. But she's 92. She didn't lower them until 92. But she had the money to play the cards that way, and she knew that. But that's pretty rare.
She goes skydiving or something? Or
well, no, a lot of that. If you're spending $60,000 a year, like she was doing at 92.
A lot of giving, charity.
A third of that is flying the family to Florida twice a year, taking them to Disney World, taking them out for dinner, buying presents and nice, you know, grandchildren graduating college. It might be a $1,000 trip to Florida, not instead of a little $20 gift. It's a $1,000 gift. So it's really heavily benevolent.
Yeah, because when you get to that age, so many things slow down. Your appetite. I mean, even today.
I kid about
you and I sat at lunch today. Well, you had half a bowl of chili. Yeah. I had two full bowls of chili.
You probably could have had a steak sandwich on top of it.
Right. So, you know, your spending certainly slows down as you get older, no doubt about it.
And everyone's a little different there, you know, but it's what it is. It's important for our listeners. This is one of the important things to consider. We're not, as always, we're not selling anything here or telling you what you should do, but you don't have to have a guaranteed withdrawal. You can just make withdrawals randomly. It's called a systematic withdrawal plan, and here's how it works with my clients. 3%, the portfolio makes 3% after expenses, so that can go out the door as income without selling any shares whatsoever. If the client wants more than 3% in income, I will take it from principal gains over time, but strategically, quarter by quarter. Because the alternative to doing it strategically, or having a hands-on manager like that, is to have a systematic approach to it, where you sell, you know, whatever is necessary to fund the monthly withdrawal. What that causes you to do, Nathan, unfortunately, is to sell stuff in down markets.
Right.
The higher end way of doing it, selective selling, is I don't sell anything that doesn't have a gain in the portfolio.
Mm.
And you just avoid losses that way. You just don't ever have them. Because for example, a client that had $500,000 at retirement, 3% is $15,000 a year. That's 3% net of expenses within the portfolio. So they could take just a dividend and get $15,000 a year to supplement Social Security or a pension, you know. But I think it's a concept that really wasn't taught to me at all. It really isn't taught that much in the industry because it's not a product. It's a gift, I tell clients. When I show you how to do it this way, and all I can tell you is the vast majority of people I talk to agree with me wholeheartedly, not just a little bit, that this is the right way to do it. Front load your money like your health will be in retirement, you know, and you don't need as much when you understand that.
Right. And with those, it's worth mentioning with those systematic withdrawal plans, you can change them as much as you want. You can say, even if you're not sure what you should be taking in retirement, you just say, give me $2,000 a month.
See
how it feels. 6 months later, you go, you know what, maybe it should be $1,500 a month.
Right.
Change it to $1,500 a month. There's no expenses. Sign a form, change it, and there's no expenses at all.
When we tell clients that, then the next question they say, yeah, what does it cost to change it? Nothing.
Right.
Just call Kim and tell her.
Right.
If I think it's an issue for your portfolio, I will get on it because I'll be informed as the manager of the account. But it's a very free, loose way of doing it, and doing it this way on a fee basis also ensures the client. I always thought the most important right every client should have, and that is to fire you if they're not happy with how you're taking care of them. And as long as you've got an account with somebody in my business, and the big question is, if I want to take this money and go out the door tomorrow morning, I don't want any penalties. Penalties indicate high commission levels paid up front, and those handcuffs are there to keep you around for a minimum number of time to make it all the math work. Is how that works. Now, that's okay in certain circumstances. You know, I don't want to be at all like the people who think one thing fits everything. One thing is never always wrong either.
Right.
I can think of a time or here or there along the way when an annuity is a reasonable choice, but not too often.
Not very often.
But I'm jaded on that one. We all know that one. I admit that openly, okay?
What would you say is one of the classic examples of a case where an annuity would be appropriate?
When it's never money.
Right.
Not IRA money.
Uh-huh.
Person's 70 years old and says, you know what? I've got to the point in my life I realize now with my spending needs, see this $50,000, I will never need it. I won't spend it. I got plenty of other money.
Yep.
So it's really people who are a little bit wealthy. You know, they got quite a good pile. And so it's the next generation. Now you can invest the money aggressively in the variable annuity with long-term growth funds because it's for the next group. And the annuity can have a death benefit on it. So if the person who's 70 was to die in a down market, the family receives the higher value. So it really protects them from any kind of market risk.
Hmm.
It works very well with what we call never money, which is just when the client says, I'll never use this.
Right.
I don't think I'll ever use this. And it takes a certain stage of life to get to a point where you can say that.
Sure.
You've got to be pretty much into your retirement years.
I would think so.
Before you say, you know what, I can't imagine me ever touching this money.
Right.
And then the options become very different because the money is now for a younger group of people, and the time horizon is now much longer, right?
Right, sure.
And so you do that, and with a guaranteed death benefit, if you're down 50% when the client dies and the children step in to receive the money, they'll get the death benefit, not the market value, whichever is higher. And some of these annuities have little death benefits that say they guarantee an event of death, the original investment, plus 5% every year. Because people buy that and think they're getting 5% return, and they're not. We've seen that before.
Sure.
Very confusing. But those annuities, you know, have their places. I never thought they were proper in IRAs, and we're seeing now some actual...
laws now being passed.
Federal laws being passed, folks out there. So if you have an annuity IRA, get somebody to take a second look at it. It probably wasn't good from the very beginning. I didn't say it was never good from the very beginning, but probably not a good choice in my opinion. And most of the brokerage companies are already moving on this, and we do have current very aggressive laws that's going to outlaw commissionable products inside IRAs when you're working with a professional. We'll see how this develops. We will keep you informed, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show. Wednesday night, Financial History Night with Nathan Bove and Steve Bove. Hey, Nathan, we're going to talk about the first corporations in America and how they came to run the economy.
That's right. The first corporations.
You cut me on this one, too.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have guessed it. Go ahead.
I stump you, huh?
Yeah, you do. You do that a lot. Yeah.
That's my goal here.
Excellent.
Railroads, of course, were the first corporations in America, and I'm going to fulfill a boyhood dream tonight and get to talk about trains. My oldest son is very excited. He's listening to me talk about railroads. But anyway, railroads were not just the first corporations in America. They also set the precedent for many of the business practices that would come in the United States. And other things like
employee benefits.
Right, yep. Pensions, regulation. The first time the government got involved in the economy regulating something was the railroads. Corporate bureaucracy started in railroads. Unions, the first massive strike that the country ever had from workers involved railroads. Modern management systems that we see in today's economy all started.
Multiple locations.
Railroads, exactly. The financing and raising of capital to start a business,
sure,
started with railroads. The when you think about like a guy who owned a factory, it took him an hour to patrol the factory and see what was going on. Railroads extended miles and miles and miles, and they had multiple train stations, and it required a hierarchy of people working.
Yep.
And a much more integrated management system to keep everybody on the same page.
You had to stop in Clayville and climb a telephone pole.
Yeah, put your hand over your eyes and take a look out.
The folks on my age remember Green Acres, the guy climbing the pole.
So the very first railroad was built in the 1830s, and that was in Baltimore, the Baltimore-Ohio Railroad, actually in 1820s.
The Iron Horse.
That's right, 1827. They took many ways, canals were the first precursor to railroads. Canals were, of course, man-made, and they were used to connect cities and make it easier to ship goods. But canals had a big disadvantage in that in the winter they froze, and you couldn't use them.
And a train can hold a lot more weight, too, than a boat can.
Exactly, right.
Those boats of that era, not today maybe. But.
Right. But the earlier rails in the country really just connected coal mines to canals or rivers, cotton fields, and the cars were really pulled by horses. They weren't even pulled by steam engines. So steam engine didn't come along until the 30s, 1830s that is. And the B&O, Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, was the first common carrier and started passenger train service in May of 1830. So by the 1830s, you started to see people travel back and forth between cities. And really, in the next 20 years, it just exploded. During the whole 19th century, every decade, the number of miles of track doubled on average. And by 1850, you had 9,000 miles of rail built in the United States. Most of the railways were in the Northeast and mid-Atlantic area.
A lot of those rails were also laid down by foreign citizens.
Absolutely.
Weren't they, I believe.
Well, I think about it, at that time, 1810, I mean, everybody's
everybody
foreign citizen.
Yeah, right. Right. Anytime after 1770.
Yeah, right, yeah. But you're absolutely right.
I remember seeing history shows about a lot of from the Middle East and
Chinese, actually.
Chinese,
with the Transcontinental Railroad, Chinese workers built a lot of the Transcontinental Railroad. That's a mouthful. Try saying that three times fast.
We talk all day.
Yeah, I know.
And talk and listen. That's
right.
It's important, too.
That's right.
We do speak a lot. So
but the one of the ways that the railroads were able to get going, and like I said, they had to it required a lot of capital to be raised. And that was one of the things they got were land grants. The federal government encouraged railroads by saying, okay, well, if you build your railroad through this area, we're going to give you the land around the track, and then you can sell that.
I was going to say, buying that land would make the whole thing not doable.
Right.
It'd be so expensive.
Right, exactly.
I would think.
By a total of 129 million acres were granted by the federal government between the years of 1855 and 1871. And then an additional 51 million acres by states alone. The federal government didn't give any money, though. They didn't actually pay companies to build railroads. It was only some states did give money to railroads to ensure that a line would go through their city. It was very crucial to a state to make sure that the train line went through their metropolitan areas.
Oh, yes.
Because it was such crucial to the economy as the middle of the century came on.
Taxpayer dollars to bring in opportunity.
That's right.
Jobs and growth.
But the railroads really just changed the economy, and really you had the economy before railroads and then after railroads. Really, it was really that stark of a difference. By the 1870s, railroads were pretty much replacing canals and turnpikes and significantly displaced steamboats as well. So a dramatic drop in the sale of steamboats, which were used to go up and down rivers and canals to transport goods. But one of the things railroads did was it lowered the cost of transportation. Like I said, canals were not available during the winter, and the railroads ran year-round. But the railroads were also safer. The likelihood of a train crash was far less than a boat sinking, so it actually lowered insurance premiums.
Right.
People didn't have to pay as much insurance to ensure that their products didn't...
Can you imagine prior to the railroads, local markets, whatever resources were needed, you had to deal with the local person.
Right.
So there was no consumer edge there. So this ability to move product around really helps consumers, drives prices down.
Absolutely.
Makes things much more competitive.
Right, right. But it was very much a boom and bust cycle that the railroads experienced, especially after the Civil War. One of the first major bubbles that happened was in 1873, which is known as the Panic of 1873. These pre-20th century panics they're not very creatively named. Just the Panic of 1873 or the Panic of 1893. But this was a severe global, actually, economic depression that happened, and that ended a rapid expansion in the railroads. What happened was after the Civil War ended, we saw a boom in railroad construction. About 35,000 miles of new track was laid after the Civil War up until the Panic. But prior to the Civil War, there was only 30,000 miles existed, so it doubled in size. Again, that was that trend we saw every 10 years about the miles of railroad that existed in the country doubled. And just connecting more people, connecting more markets.
That's a 7% growth rate.
Right.
Doubling in 10 years.
So one of the things that happened out of the Panic of 1873 was the very first strike that the country ever saw, the very first time workers kind of got together and organized, and it was the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, which began in West Virginia after the famous Baltimore and Ohio Railroad cut wages for the third time in a year. And the strike lasted about 45 days and was put down by local militias and federal troops. But the strike spread to all states all over the country, to New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Illinois, Missouri. About 100,000 workers were involved in the strikes, and a lot of fatalities, too. About 100 people were killed in unrest across the country. A very strange time in our country's history. Pittsburgh alone, strikers burned 39 buildings, 104 engines, 46 passenger cars, thousands of freight cars.
Yeah, that's going to solve the problem.
Yeah, right.
But we see it going on today.
We see it every all through history. No different. It's no different. No. But damage is estimated between...
Behavior that will not help the cause whatsoever.
Right, exactly. Right. Damage is estimated between $5 and $10 million during that great railroad strike. And that was back in 1877.
And now you want me to hire you back and give you a raise. After you do that, think about it, right?
Right, wow, right.
Pretty crazy.
But after the strike, we saw a consolidation because a lot of the companies had filed bankruptcy. But the railroads had become the nation's largest employer outside of the agricultural sector by this time.
How do you compete if you want to be a railroad? What do you do? Run a track next to your track and go faster?
Yes, that's what happened. A lot. You saw overbuilding.
Overbuilding.
Overbuilding, and lots of people seeing other people making money in the railroads.
Right, right, right.
So it was very easy to convince people to invest in railroads. Most of the money that came to supply the financial capital for the railroads came from the Northeast in America, but also from Britain. A lot of British investors invested in railroads. And
I wonder if there were railroads already there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Railroads certainly
had some experience with it.
Certainly experienced the same kind of growth over there. Right. But Britain, of course, a much smaller landmass than America, so there wasn't as much there to build upon. One of the greatest railroad consolidators, so we talked about before on the show, was J.P. Morgan. Morgan was famous for consolidating lots of railroads, and he not only raised capital in the U.S. and Europe, like I talked about, but also helped organize the railroads, and that was his claim to fame. He really fought against speculators, for the most part. I'm not going to say he's completely innocent of speculation, but for the most part, and it makes sense, because most of Morgan's clients wanted sound, stable investments.
And money in and out a lot disturbs things.
Right. Well, all of Morgan's financial transactions were involved in debt, not stocks. Morgan didn't deal in stocks. He dealt in bonds and in that way. So it was kind of common sense that his investors didn't want to see values of these companies going up and down and going bankrupt. They'd rather see them just steady growth,
dividend,
churn out the dividends, right? And that's what they were looking
rental
for.
Rental income.
So one of his goals was to organize them and get them more consolidated and more efficient, more effective. Like you just mentioned, if a competitor wanted to build a rail across next to his railroad, that's not effective. You know, you're just going to drive your prices down, and no one's making any money.
What are you going to have, 36 railroads running next to each other, competing against
each other? It's fast. I have a book that shows
so difficult.
A map of all the railroads in the country every 10 years, and you can see it growing and growing and growing. And it's by 1900, it was out of control. I mean, there's so many lines.
And there was a consolidation period.
Right, following that. But one of the other big panics that happened was in 1893, another great panic that happened and another depression. And this was caused by shaky financing and overbuilding and railroads again. And by 1894, a quarter of all railroads in the United States had failed. So it was really after that turn of the 20th century we saw a kind of a slowdown and say, okay, let's take a breath here. Let's not keep building tracks on top of tracks.
What a hectic time. Exciting time.
Exciting time, for sure.
But hectic and nerve-wracking and so much unknown.
Yep. And this was the first time that the government got involved, like I said, in the economy. Started to regulate rates in 1887. Right. The Interstate Commerce Act was passed. This was the very first time. It took 100 years for the government to eventually pass regulation in the economy.
Well, there surely is needed in certain areas.
Sometimes.
And the safety, especially for people.
Yeah, there was a lot of clamoring in the public for that. Yeah, sure. You know, the monopolistic tendencies of the railroads really bothered people.
Right. We just don't care about anybody anymore.
Right. Yeah.
We're trying to avoid that.
At first, there was this love relationship. I mean, this people enamored with this technology and being able to travel to New York from Boston in a matter of a couple of days when it used to take you a week,
a couple
of weeks.
Amazing.
You know, it was just,
so, I mean,
imagine.
The advancements that were occurring at that time were just all so big.
Right. Yeah. Just crazy.
Very exciting.
And bringing markets together was really the thing that really changed the economy. But that's pretty much the short end of the story. We didn't talk much about the Transcontinental Railroad, but maybe we will if we have time. We're going to go to a break pretty soon, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about how they changed after the 20th century and how like Amtrak came around.
Very good. This is the Money Talk Show, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790. This is your station for talk and business. We're here every evening at 5 p.m. Tune in when you can. Nathan and I are talking about railroad companies on our financial history show tonight. Nathan, what are some of the largest railroad companies today?
Probably the largest one, I think, as far as market cap is concerned, is probably the Union Pacific Corporation, which has been around forever. You know, they were one of the companies that actually built the Transcontinental Railroad. But the railroads have had a pretty good run, actually, the last year. The index, I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal U.S. Railroad Index right now. It's up about 45% over the last year. But if you look out the last 2 years, not so good. It had a pretty rough 2015 year. So the two-year return is, you know, about negative 15%. So like always, it depends on when you get in and when you get out. But some of the
not,
other...
Not a speculative play, a railroad. That's a long-term hold,
so.
I would think.
Well, I mean, it depends on what...
decent little dividend.
Yeah, it depends on which company you get involved in. You know, I mean, like Union Pacific, no, that's not a speculative stock. I don't think so at all. Yeah, it's got a little dividend of 2.12 on Union Pacific.
Okay.
2016's annual return was 35%.
Tax advantage, too. American company, if you buy it with cash.
Yeah, and I'm looking... one of the things I kind of wanted to look at was the 2008 annual return. And I took the four largest railroad companies today, which would be the Canadian National Railway, the CSX Corporation, Norfolk Southern Corporation, and Union Pacific. And all of them had a better return in 2008 than the S&P did. Some of them, not like Norfolk, had only went down 5% in 2008.
So a little bit defensive there.
I think so, a little defensive. But it's a growth and income stock. You know,
right.
It's not a huge dividend, but not zero.
good holding in a growth and income portfolio.
Yeah, the CSX Corporation, same. The ticker is CSX. Actually, the last couple of years has ranked 7th out of all railroad stocks. It had a really good year last year. I think it was up almost doubled in price, and that's a really big company. I wouldn't consider that really speculative either. I mean, its market cap is $43 billion. You know, that's a pretty big company.
Yeah, sure is. No problem selling that stock if you own it.
Right. Yeah, very marketable.
Very marketable. Very,
that's
very,
that's right.
Exactly right.
But you know, it's funny. We talked about. I just mentioned the Union Pacific is a really old railroad, and it was one of the railroads that was contracted by the federal government to build the Transcontinental Railroad back in the 1860s, along with another corporation. That was the only time the federal government actually paid money to railroad, to build a railroad. And the reason they had to do that was that because no company was interested in doing it. None of the companies thought that it was profitable.
Right.
They look
right.
at all this land out there. There's no guarantee that there's going to be traffic on the train. You know, there's Native right. Americans, hostile
sure,
population.
Sure, tracks up on you, train goes off the track.
No one wanted to get involved with it, but the government was so gung-ho, Abraham Lincoln specifically, was very gung-ho on it as healing the nation, a symbol of bringing the country together. So they paid
fascinating.
They paid money to these companies to do this and overpaid terribly. And there was a lot of corruption that happened, not a lot of oversight in the government at that time. And you can imagine they were very distracted with the Civil War going on. But basically what happened was because these companies realized they weren't going to make any money going forward with the railroad, they wanted to make money building the railroad. So what the companies did was they made these construction companies that were owned by the same shareholders. And it'd be like if I was the railroad company and you were the construction company, right? And I'm talking to the government negotiating the price. And I say, well, the construction company told me it's going to cost XYZ, you know, to, you know, $10,000 a mile.
Right. And then we have dinner. Then we have dinner together.
And the government said, yeah. And the government goes, well, I don't know. Is that what it costs?
Is that what it costs? We've never done this before.
We've never done this before. Right. Yeah. He goes, let me go talk to them again. You know what? They just told me it's going to be a little bit more expensive. That's really what happened.
Remember, I told you a long time ago, there's only one thing better than being good at what you do, as being the only one that does what you do.
Yeah. That's a perfect example.
Yeah, right.
But unfortunately,
right.
there was a lot of corruption, too, that happened. A lot of the shareholders, one of the guys' name was Durant, who headed the Union Pacific at the time, and the Credit Mobilier of America, which was the construction company that built for the Union Pacific, bribed a lot of senators to pass friendly legislation that provided the funds and the grants. Not a good mark on our country's history, unfortunately.
Got it done, though.
It did get done, and there were other transcontinental roads that happened after that in the north and in the south, but the track was very poorly put together just because they weren't motivated. The motivation was not there on their part.
Well, they knew the demand wouldn't be there for a while, if ever.
Right, right.
And what you shared earlier was that those risks are unique. You go into wilderness areas,
hostile
natives, and they want you there. Don't blame them by the way that they don't want you there.
Yeah, right.
I dig it. I get it.
No doubt.
You know, workers are at risk.
Yeah, building now, through the Sierra Nevadas and the Rocky Mountains.
Now what happens, you have three workers that are massacred by whatever cause out there. Is now the railroad now sued?
Yeah, good point.
You know, so that's what the kind of risk that they saw was big.
Yeah, huge risk.
Huge risk,
yeah.
But is it funny, we look back, you know, on many of these things in our country's development, we see some of these things that were huge risks, you know, just can't imagine them not happening. So somebody had to have vision, somebody had to see through it all,
right?
And usually it's somebody there that does it.
True.
Sure is, be one of those people.
The American way.
Hey, thanks, Nate, for a great another history night on the Money Talk
no
Show.
Problem.
Tune in tomorrow night for Don Sowa right here on AM 790, your station for Talkin' Business. Have a good, safe evening.
the great big world. I see them lurking in bookstores, working for the public radio. Can the babies around, the sack on their back, moving careful and slow. It's money that matters. You hear what I say? It's money that matters. In the USA. Bye.